Hello, I'm Andy Burnham. Welcome to Sparks. This week, Century FM, Ireland's first legal countrywide commercial service, closes after barely 2 years on air. Swords to plowshares, how imaging technology used in the Gulf War could prevent future river tragedies like the Marchioness disaster. We explain how the new Philips digital compact cassette works, the technical cock-ups behind the launch delays at BSB, the latest developments in national commercial radio in this country, let's hope they're more successful than Century, and what prospects are there for the electric car? That, along with your letters, is Sparks for this week. Every week on Radiofax, the frequencies 6205, 12255, and now 3910 for the winter in the UK.
Lying on the floor, so
a letter from David Broome, who lives in Whipton, in Exeter, in Devon. I've been listening to your Monday and Tuesday programmes on Radio Facts, and they're excellent. I tune in every day on 6205. I used to make my reports on a Raycal RA17L receiver, but that's just broken down. I have to rely now on a 7-band Philips Deluxe radio with its loop aerial. On the 5th of November, your programme included an interview with the Caroline crew and the future of Radio Caroline. I was interested in this and would like to know more about it. 2 months ago, I wrote to John Hannam, NP, about licences in this country and why it is difficult to have one. Also, why the Broadcasting Bill 1990 is unfair to those who show a genuine interest in broadcasting, such as Radio Facts and Caroline. 2 months later, I received a Home Office reply, and I will enclose a copy of this to you, which I'll read out in a minute. The letter doesn't say a lot, but at least if enough people write to their MPs, the Broadcasting Bill might be changed if a majority opposes this act in support of easier licences. Apart from Radio DXing, I enjoy jogging, swimming, walking, collecting stamps, and writing. I'm 26, a part-time student, and hoping maybe to enter into the world of broadcasting in some form or other. I hope to hear more of the future of Radio Caroline and the Ross Revenge. Will Radio Caroline continue to broadcast in the North Sea when on air, I wonder? Well, the answer to that's been altered by the events of the last few weeks, unfortunately, hasn't it? Keep up the good work, Radio Facts, in the near future. Well, thanks very much, David, for that letter. And here's the reply he had back from his MP.
From John Hannam, MP, House of Commons, London. Dear Mr. Broome, further to my letter of the 10th of September, I enclose a detailed reply I have received from the Broadcasting Minister, which I hope will be of assistance to you. Thank you for bringing this matter to my attention. Yours sincerely, John Hannam, Member of Parliament for Exeter. And the letter enclosed from the Home Office, from the Parliamentary Under Secretary of State for Broadcasting, Peter Lloyd. He says, thank you for your letter of 10th of September, with which you enclosed this one from Mr. D. Broome of Whipton in Exeter. Mr. Broome asks why stations such as Radio Facts and Radio Caroline have not been given licences to broadcast in this country. Perhaps I should explain first, by way of background, that until the beginning of this year, the only organisations licensed to broadcast programmes for general reception were the BBC and the IBA. However, the Broadcasting Act 1990 introduced a new framework in which the Radio Authority took over responsibility for licensing all independent, i.e. non-BBC, radio services, and regulating their activities under a lighter regime. This should facilitate a major expansion of radio services over the next few years, with independent radio services competing with the BBC at the national level for the first time, and with many new local services addressing the tastes and interests of listeners more closely than was possible under the previous arrangements. The Radio Authority clearly cannot license stations in every area or for every community at once. They are moving as quickly as possible within the resources available and hope to license about 30 new stations each year. National radio licences are awarded by a process involving competitive tender, while the key to winning a local radio licence is to offer a service which would enhance the range of listening choice in the area concerned. There is therefore no reason in principle why Radio Caroline or Radio Facts should not put in bids for one of the national radio licences or apply for a local licence when advertised. I understand, however, that Radio Facts would wish to broadcast on shortwave. At present, the Radio Authority does not have access to any shortwave frequencies. This is primarily due to two reasons. Firstly, the historical position, which I have outlined, has meant that only the BBC has been permitted to use shortwave frequencies. in this country. For broadcasting its world service. Secondly, since shortwave transmissions have the characteristic of travelling very great distances, they have enormous potential to cause interference, and very careful planning has been necessary to ensure adequate reception for existing services within the band, which is highly congested. In the circumstances, it could be difficult to accommodate new services on shortwave, and the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, which, in funding the BBC's World Service, currently has the major interest in the use of shortwave, may in any case first wish to examine the wider implications of any proposal to extend the use of this waveband. Yours, Peter Lloyd. That's a letter from Peter Lloyd, who's Minister of State at the Home Office with responsibility for broadcasting, sent to David Broome's MP.
Well, it's not clear from David's letter whether he mentioned that Radiofax wanted a licence for shortwave. If not, then it shows at least that we're getting their attention and they know what we want. So if you'd like to write to your MP, please send us the reply that you get. We'd be very pleased if you would do that. It's Sparks on Radiofax.
Relax, take it easy. Slow down.
Slow down.
Relax.
Relax.
It's too late to worry. Slow down.
Slow down. Take it easy.
In car design and technology, the lure of electricity. Back in 1966, when I was a young staff journalist on the weekly magazine Motor, I wrote a long article surveying the prospects of the electric car. Then, as now, it was obvious that the concept would never be viable with heavy lead-acid batteries. But it was a time of hope, with numerous alternative forms of electrical generation or storage being researched, such as fuel cells, the zinc air cell, the lithium chlorine cell, and the sodium sulfur cell. Yet, there were precious few electric cars on the streets. Roughly 10 years later, the shock of the fuel crisis had inspired a massive worldwide program of research into alternative forms of propulsion, from the gas turbine to the Stirling engine, from steam power to, yes, the electric car again. In Britain, ministers of transport wheeled out ancient prototypes, including a converted Mini, barely capable of dragging along the ton or more of lead-acid batteries, which were squashing its springs flat. At about that time, we on Motor borrowed an Enfield electric car said to be suitable for city commuting, but it hadn't the range to get us from our offices in Sutton to the centre of London and back. But it was a time of hope, and people were still talking of the great promise of the fuel cell, the zinc air cell, the lithium chlorine cell, and the sodium sulphur cell. Yet, there were precious few electric cars on the streets. Another 15 years has elapsed since then, bringing us to the present and a rash of recent announcements about electric cars, several of which were on display at the Frankfurt show. BMW have built one, IAD have built two, Peugeot have declared their interest, and Volkswagen are known to be negotiating with the Swiss SMH company to produce a joint venture Swatch electric car. And once again, people are talking hopefully about at least one alternative to the lead-acid battery, the sodium sulfur cell. Yet there are still precious few electric cars on the streets, though, very courageously, Fiat have made themselves the first major manufacturer to offer an electric car for sale to the general public, the Panda-based Electra. In view of this melancholy history of persistent non-achievement, are there any reasons why we should expect things to turn out differently this time? The short answer is yes, perhaps. Maybe. In fact, there are two sets of reasons to be considered, one political, one technological. As many will already know, the political impetus comes from the state of California, which continues to struggle with the air pollution problem of the Los Angeles basin, where the fumes of 9 million vehicles tend to be trapped by the peculiar local atmospheric conditions. The huge reductions in vehicle exhaust emissions which have been enforced since the early 70s have certainly led to an improvement in air quality, but the Californians are calling for further improvements, which can only be met through an almost draconian tightening of the existing legislation, plus the introduction of some further requirements. One of these is that from 1998 onwards, 2% of all cars produced for the Californian market must be ZEVs, or zero emission vehicles, and that means electric cars. In the meantime, encouragement will be given to the development of ULEVs, or ultra-low emission vehicles, and here the Californian legislature is thinking of electric stroke internal combustion hybrids. Of course, the whole concept is desperately specious, since the electric car is most emphatically not a zero-emission vehicle. Unless its electricity comes from a renewable source, such as falling water, it is simply a vehicle which transfers the pollution from a small local source to a large remote one, the power station. And while that might be fine for the Los Angeles basin, it doesn't do much for atmospheric pollution on a global basis. True, it might be a bit easier to clean up the flue gases of a large power station than the exhaust gases of an individual car. Agreed, the power station itself may be highly efficient. But then, there are losses in the power transmission lines, losses in the battery charger, losses in the battery, and losses in the electric motor itself. It's therefore highly unlikely that an electric car system from power source to road will achieve much greater efficiency than the 15% or so extracted from a petrol-driven car, which is being driven on part throttle and is fitted with a three-way catalyst. This hardly represents a masterful strategy for the CO2 reduction said to be essential if global warming is to be curbed. Nonetheless, it is, as we shall see, an initiative to which many motor manufacturers and design companies are striving to respond. But if the political climate is now more favourable to the electric car than ever before, the technological climate is a good deal more complex. There are some things, for instance, which haven't changed very much. Although lead-acid batteries have certainly improved in design and performance since my 1966 starting point, their energy storage capacity by weight is still abysmally low, several hundred times lower than petrol. The assessment of range, too, continues to border on the fraudulent. The good news about some of the methods used is that they call for the vehicle to be fully laden. The bad news is that they never involve hills, often allow accessories such as heaters to be disconnected, and always involve new batteries. But the energy storage capacity of an old battery may be only 80% or less of a new one. But there are other things which have changed a great deal, and one of them is cheap electronic computing power. What can be routinely achieved today is in the realm of science fiction compared to what was possible in 1966. The microchip still doesn't make it possible to extract a quart from a pint pot of lead-acid batteries, but it does make facilities such as regenerative braking easy to achieve and mean that hybrid cars can easily be given the very complex and sophisticated control strategies needed to realise high efficiency and low emissions. And it's just possible that an intelligently designed hybrid could be sufficiently practical to be commercially viable and sufficiently clean for the environmentalists. The technological climate has also changed profoundly in an entirely different way. During the past 6 or 7 years, the world's automotive industry has displayed an unprecedented willingness to conceive, develop, and introduce novel engineering concepts. Four-wheel steering, variable valve timing, and multi-link suspension systems are just three examples. This change in attitude means that manufacturers are likely to be less reluctant than they were in the past to adopt such innovations as a new form of continuously variable transmission if it were considered to confer an advantage on an electric car or hybrid. A more specific factor in favour of the electric car is that two European companies, Brown Boveri and Chloride RWE, have started small-scale pilot production of sodium-sulphur batteries. These are composed of several thousand cells, which have to be sealed within a double-walled insulated stainless steel container, partly to help maintain a working temperature of around 300 degrees centigrade, partly to afford protection against the escape of the two violently reactive elements. Practical necessities of this sort have drastically reduced the energy density or storage efficiency originally expected, once estimated to be 10 times better than lead-acid batteries. A superiority of between 2 and 4 is now accepted as being more realistic. Against all this, the electric car still has formidable obstacles to overcome before it gains widespread acceptance. Consider the Fiat Elettra, for example. It will certainly have exceptional fuel consumption, even by small car standards. But it costs around £12,000, compared to the £6,000 or so asked for a conventional mid-range Panda, will have a range of only 40-odd miles on lead-acid batteries and will require a further expenditure of several thousand pounds in about 3 years' time when its battery pack needs replacement. No more than about 1,000 charge or use cycles is being predicted by the relevant traction battery manufacturers. The Californian initiative, moreover, may not work. Demanding a 2% production of electric cars is one thing, getting people to buy them quite another. The Californian legislature were lucky in the early 70s when they enacted exhaust emission regulations which were almost impossible to meet. Lucky because Bosch just happened to come up with the three-way catalyst technology that solved the problem. But there's no law that says the same thing will happen again. Some feats, like flying to the moon, will always be technologically difficult and very expensive, no matter how scientifically advanced a society becomes. All about electric cars there and their prospects, and that was by Anthony Curtis in Car Design and Technology.
Here's a letter from Geiger Paul, writing from Deutsche Kreuz in Austria. Maybe his name is Paul Geiger, because I know they write the surname first in Hungary, however I'm not sure about Austria. The letter goes, I was able to listen to Radio Fax daily on my holiday in Fuerteventura, in the Canaries, in Spain. Well, that's brilliant. Thanks for your letter from Austria.
The national commercial radio station, Century Radio, collapsed. This is how we recorded the story, off-air in Dublin.
98 FM, Dublin. News on the hour.
It's a cold, wintry night in Dublin with a current city temperature of 5 degrees. I'm Nick Adams. In 98FM News this hour, the Minister for Communications has said he's disappointed by the closure of Century Radio. But Seamus Brennan said he's not giving up on the policy of offering choice and competition in the broadcasting arena, and that it's too early to condemn the broadcasting legislation. The Minister said he expects the National Independent Radio franchise to be re-advertised after the Independent Radio and Television Commission has seen his proposed revision of the Broadcasting Act. Century Radio listeners and employees learned of the station's closure earlier tonight, with the news being the last item broadcast by the station.
A headline at 6 o'clock. Century Radio has announced in the last few minutes that the station is closing down with immediate effect and the company is being put into liquidation.
The one and only news story on the final news bulletin on Century Radio. The troubled station then went off air with the loss of 50 jobs. Stunned staff were told the news at a meeting this evening. In its final weeks, Century Radio launched a major advertising campaign in an effort to boost its listenership. One of the founding investors of the station, Oliver Barry, left, and Capital Radio of London, one of the newer investors, pumped in an extra £1.5 million. The last-ditch effort to save the station came to an abrupt end this evening. For 98FM News, I'm Gerry O'Connor.
The opposition parties say they're shocked at the sudden closure of Century Radio.
There was huge surprise at the news of the closure at Leinster House. Century Radio began broadcasting in September 1989. £400,000 was spent on advertising before it went on air. Well-known figures like Terry Wogan, Chris de Burg and promoter Oliver Barry were among the initial investors. But the station was always in difficulty, never sure of its programme format and never reaching a significant share of the national listenership. Eventually, even Oliver Barry sold his shares, which seemed to have triggered a change of heart by both their British and institutional backers. For 98FM News at Leinster House, I'm Conor Lanahan.
Fine Gael spokesman on communications, Austin Curry, condemned this evening's news.
It again underlines the total failure of the government's broadcasting policy. Century was supposed to be an alternative national radio service. Its failure almost certainly means not only the end of that concept, but further undermines any possibility of an alternative national television channel.
The Labour Party says it regrets the loss of employment to all those connected with Century Radio. The party's spokesperson on communications, Toddy O'Sullivan, says their plight is a direct result of the triumph of market ideology over practical realities. And staff at Century Radio said they were shocked by tonight's news and that they had no idea what was happening to their jobs. They now face the gloomy prospect of signing on the dole coming up to Christmas.
50 people at Century are now out of a job. Clearly upset, some of them in tears, they say they'll now wait and see how much money, if any, they will get once a liquidator has been appointed by the courts. An NUJ spokesman for the National Union of Journalists said he would be defending the rights of the employees. Staff say they don't feel any bitterness towards management at this stage, even though some of them had their paychecks bounced by management last week. For 98FM News at Century Radio headquarters, I'm Andrew Hanlon.
In other news, Soviet President Mikhail...
Recorded off-air there from 98FM Hot Hits in Dublin. Will Britain's national commercial network go the same way? Apple dispute ends out of court by Tony Mitchell in ProSound News. After a court case that looked at one stage as if it might go on to break the English High Court record of 191 days, the contract dispute between Apple Computers and the Beatles company, Apple Corp, finally ground to a halt with an out-of-court settlement. The hearing of the action, centering on Apple Corp's claim that the computer company had flouted a 1981 agreement concerning use of the Apple logo on computers with musical applications, began almost a year ago and was expected to last 12 weeks. In fact, it stretched to 116 days in the High Court, a 10-day spell in the Court of Appeal, and even one day before the European Commission in Brussels. Both sides agreed to pay their own costs in the action, unofficially estimated at £7 million. But the terms of the settlement were confidential, and Apple Computers was still unable to comment on what the implications of the settlement would be for future applications of its products in the music field. But the settlement could be seen as the latest in a series of conciliatory moves by the company, long regarded as the renegade geniuses of the computer business. Not a week before, Apple chairman John Sculley had signed what was described as a landmark deal with IBM, bringing an end to the rivalry between the two companies in the personal computer market. And just after the court case, Sony confirmed that it is now in talks with Apple about a joint multimedia venture. The two companies have already cooperated on the development of the PowerBook notebook version of the Macintosh, which was to be released along with other new and uprated Macintosh products. That by Tony Mitchell.
If you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radiofact Sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact standard size in-car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kHz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England, 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England, 0483 276 477. Or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
From Electronics Times, a joke. During World War II, Hitler called in his top scientists and told them the country is desperately short of butter because all the fields are being dug up by war machines. But we've got lots of horses, and they generate lots of shit. So I want you to develop a method of making butter out of horse shit. Come back in 3 months. At the appointed time, the scientist returned, and the leading one stood up and said, "We're 50% functional." "What do you mean, 50% functional?" Hitler asked. "Well," the scientist replied, "it spreads easily." That joke was told with grim irony at a board meeting of British Satellite Broadcasting, the TV venture that crashed so spectacularly a year ago this month. Whenever the board asked for a report on the progress of the DMAC chip being developed by ITT, the technicians would reply that it was not yet ready, but it was a certain percentage functional. The meeting is chronicled in Dished, The Rise and Fall of British Satellite Broadcasting, a book from publisher Simon & Schuster. The book reveals the true extent of the technical and strategic mistakes that led to the demise of BSB. By February 1989, the chip was 85% functional, and with just 6 months until BSB was due to launch, hopelessly behind schedule. It was slowly dawning on the board members that even if the chip was 99% functional, it would still be as useless as Hitler's butter. The board, made up largely of marketing men who had little understanding of technology, became painfully familiar with the word iteration, the 6-week cycle of chip modifications. Anthony Simmons Gooding, BSB's chief executive, later said the word was written across his back. The knock-on effects of the delays with the chip meant the receiver manufacturers were unlikely to have their products in the shops in time for the launch. The problems were compounded by the Squareal, the square satellite dish that BSB, to its cost, so closely focused its corporate identity on. The Squareal was the idea of John Collins, who had patented it through his small company in Fife, called Fortel. He phoned BSB to see if they were interested, and they were. The marketing men had been looking for a unique selling point to differentiate BSB from Sky Television, which Rupert Murdoch had just announced. They also needed a dish to show at a press conference, called to demonstrate how DMAC gave better quality pictures than the PAL technology Sky planned to use. BSB actually signed a deal with Fortel less than 5 hours before the conference began. It wasn't just the press that was surprised by the Squareal. The three companies that would also make the receivers, Ferguson, Solora and Tatung, were also present and their jaws dropped too. Nobody had actually asked them whether it would interface with their equipment. And with good reason. The Squareal existed only as a concept. Unbeknown to the press, the product displayed at the conference was a wooden model. It remained at the concept stage for a long time, and the contract with Fortel was later revoked and passed to STC. BSB was a company run by marketing executives and saddled with technologies that would have perplexed most engineers. Simmons Gooding assumed the technologies would sort themselves out, and whenever the director of operations tried to voice his concerns to the technical director, he was given the brush off. The DMAC chip was one of the most complex consumer ICs ever designed. The decision to develop a DMAC IC rather than use an off-the-shelf D2MAC chip was forced on the BSB by engineers at the Independent Broadcasting Authority, who wanted to earn income off the IBA's DMAC patents. But perhaps one of the lessons of the saga is that while the marketing men could not manage technology, the engineers had an even worse grasp of commercial realities.
Richard Baum writing in Electronics Times. Thanks to Elaine Richards from Shortwave magazine for sending us a copy of the latest issue in which we're mentioned, as is Sparks. 6205 has been reported by all monitors. And a letter from Manfred Lepp writing from Subdfundibor in Iloilo City in the Philippines. Oh, but looking down the letter, unfortunately... Well, still, fortunately, forgetting the report, but it's not a new country for us. He heard the programme while he was on holiday in Germany, in Munich to be exact, using a portable receiver, Sangian ATS-808, with a telescopic antenna, very popular radio. Also, hello to Neil Oakey in Whitstable in Kent. Thanks for your letter. If you'd like to write to us, we'd love to hear from you. The address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. I guarantee to read your letter out on air, and if you send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1, you'll get a reply, including a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site. The address once more: Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. And don't forget that Radio Fax can now also be heard on 3910.
What do you do if you believe the electronics industry has the potential solution to the problem of visibility that played a significant part in the Marchioness disaster, where 51 lives were lost, and nobody in government is prepared to take any action? If you are Nick Flaherty, Special Features Editor of Electronic Engineering, your next step is to try and prove the point. With an infrared imager, borrowed from those who build similar equipment to the Tornado, strapped to the front of a boat, borrowed from the Port of London Authority, he set off up the River Thames. In the wake of the Marchioness disaster in August 1989, we suggested the use of modern imaging technology as the way of avoiding such tragedies. In the intervening months, the accident report has been released, and the crew of the dredger Bow Bell put on trial, and yet it appears no one has seriously looked at the potential of any imaging system. Sadly, the report dismisses the technology, merely stating that imaging has advanced in recent years, and the report does not recommend any further action. With the outbreak of peace, there are several military imaging systems that could be the basis of commercial systems, a perfect example of turning swords into plowshares. Infrared thermal imaging is such a technology. So, to prove the point, we decided to set up our own experiment using images similar to those used on the reconnaissance tornadoes in the Gulf. It's 10 o'clock on a dark October evening, and Electronic Engineering is on the River Thames with a forward-looking infrared thermal imager, following pleasure boats down the river as those on board disco the night away. With the help of Stuart Smith and Colin Shaw of Computing Devices in Hastings and the Port of London Authority, we took a PLA launch out to test the effectiveness of thermal imaging as a lookout system on the river. A principal contributory factor in the accident was that visibility from the wheelhouse of each vessel was seriously restricted, and a nighttime imaging system has potential for overcoming such problems. Computing Devices manufacture the video systems used for the imager, used on the GR1 Tornado during the Gulf War for the nighttime identification of mobile Scud bases. The imager we used is not a military version and is manufactured by FLIR Systems of Portland, Oregon. The imager is gimbal mounted on a metal stand, which was secured to a rail at the front of the Port of London Authority launch, Westbourne, and no other modifications were necessary. The imager is intended for mounting on helicopters and has full 360-degree rotation, although the positioning restricted the view to 180 degrees around the front of the launch. The imager uses a mercury cadmium tellurium MCT 2x4 TDI time delay and integration array that is scanned serially, giving a real-time output that is compatible with television and radar screens. The spectral band is 8 to 12 micrometers, with a minimum resolvable temperature differential of 0.16 degrees centigrade, which was sufficient to distinguish the hull of a boat from the superstructure and to see the paint of the name on the side of the vessel. The imager is cooled by a rotary split Stirling cycle 0.25 watt cooler. A monitor and video recorder were set up in the cabin of the launch, and the gimbal was remotely controlled. The imager, monitor and VCR were powered by a portable generator and converter for the necessary 28 volts DC. The images were stored on broadcast quality video cassette. Starting from Tower Pier, just upstream of Tower Bridge, we travelled upriver to the Cannon Street Bridge and Southwark Bridge, where the Marchioness accident occurred. The arches of the bridge at the side of the river are dark, but no more so than for any of the other bridges. We then followed a vessel downriver, past Tower Bridge and down to Wapping to test the imager in the darker stretches away from the bridges. The imager was able to pick up a duck in the water and a cup in the hand of a seaman on deck. The warehouses and buildings at the side of the river show how the imager deals with background images. A passenger launch, very similar to the Marchioness, was travelling upriver, so we followed to see what the craft looked like from behind in the image on the river. From the front of the PLA launch with unaided vision, the craft in front blended into the general lights of boats on the river, of the bridges and of the buildings at the side. In the infrared image, the darkness of the river separates the boat from the other heat sources. The most notable feature is heat of the engine in the boat, which is clear. This also heats up the hull of the boat and creates a highly visible band in the imager just above the waterline. This is distinct both from the darkness of the water and from the colder superstructure, and benefits greatly from the contrast. People outside on the superstructure are also extremely clear in the imager. After finding that the image of the pleasure boat was just as clear under several bridges and further over to one side of the river, we left the party to continue. One comment on the imager from an independent observer was that there was nothing that you could not already see, which is true from the low level of the PLA launch, but a great advantage when the image is in a blind spot or the weather is foul with rain, mist or fog. In the hour that we were out on the river, we saw four pleasure boats and one other, a quiet night. According to the Port of London Authority, there can be up to 22 pleasure boats on the river at any one time, along with the commercial craft. All small craft on the river are now carrying fluorescent banners on the back for visibility, which is excellent during the day. At night, the banners are illuminated and are essentially invisible. It is the lights that are the visible element. One of the problems with technologies such as charge-coupled devices and image intensifiers is that they are swamped by the lights on each bridge and the safety lights on the back of the vessels. This is not a problem for the FLIR. The PLA launch carries river radar, but this is not used often, as too many ghost images are generated from the buildings surrounding the river, and it is only used in case of fog. One of the main recommendations of the Marchioness Inquiry by the Marine Accident Investigation Branch was that vessels more than 130 feet long, with a wheelhouse at the back, should also have a forward lookout who is in radio or telephone communication with the wheelhouse. If no other option can be found, the report's recommendation is that an extra crew member is employed specifically for this task. The Bow Bell had a forward lookout and was equipped with walkie-talkies, but the master of the vessel thought they were broken. River and shipping laws require the master of a vessel to ensure that a proper lookout was kept by all available means, and the report says it is therefore probable that the launch, the Marchioness, was in the blind arc from the wheelhouse for virtually the entire time that she ought to have been in view. Design faults with respect to visibility from the bridge during the construction of the Bow Bell and in the conversion of the Marchioness were explicitly listed as contributing to the disaster. The report says that both designs should not have been allowed by the Department of Transport. Computing Devices has also worked with Hughes Aircraft in the United States on the development of an infrared imager for a rifle night sight, using an MCT imager with thermoelectric cooling. This is less expensive, silent, and a more compact solution. The main problem with the sight was the small field of view of around 5 degrees, deliberately for a gun sight, giving higher magnification. Commercial applications would require less magnification and so could get a field of view of, say, 20 or 25 degrees. Additional optics and basic signal processing could increase the field of view to a usable 45 degrees without much loss of resolution. The prototype version of the sight cost around $15,000, although Hughes expect the cost to come down to around $5,000 in large volumes. Commercial volumes for lookouts, security systems, etc. could bring the cost down to around $2,000. With a monitor installed in the wheelhouse and an image sensor at the front aimed at the waterline about 10 metres in front, would offer the steersman full visibility. A sensor at the rear with a split-screen monitor would give all-round visibility. The infrared sensor operation, although initially expensive, would be far cheaper than an option offered in the MIAB report, such as having a hydraulically raised wheelhouse. An imaging system is also cheaper than employing a member of the crew, specifically as a lookout. The use of such images as a retrofit or as a design option would be a direct way of tackling the problem. If the view from the bridge is restricted, it is irrelevant if the other boats on the river are well lit, as they cannot be seen. The imager also has the advantage of giving visibility in fog and heavy rain, increasing confidence that there is nothing directly in front of the vessel. Such images would also mean small pleasure craft, such as yachts and rowing boats, could be spotted and avoided, and giving help in cases of people falling overboard. We are not suggesting that there should be blanket government contracts for the development of low-cost infrared imaging systems, although this would be very welcome. Some form of cost engineering on a system could provide specific research contracts for the cost-sensitive components, such as the imaging element. That would make a system less of a cost burden. Legislation to include an imager as a legal requirement would give the necessary volume to drive down the cost. there is clearly a vast array of potential technology available which could be used to prevent tragedies like the Marchioness from recurring. What the results of our investigation demand is that an appropriate arm of government carry out or fund a serious evaluation of the current state of all aspects of infrared imaging technology for shipboard use. For those who wish to search for them, there are always a million reasons for doing nothing. On their heads must now rest any future disasters. That piece about imaging on riverboats was published in Electronic Engineering.
Caroline CD called The Legend Lives On. The CD contains 44 tracks taking you through some of the great events of Radio Caroline, from the first broadcasts in 1964 with Simon D, test transmissions from Caroline North with Daffy Don Allen, Tony Prince in 1966, other great names like Robbie Dale, Crispian St. John, Andy Archer and Peter Chicago. One track features the female DJs through the 80s, and you'll hear too memorable Caroline commercials and jingles, and about the collapse of the highest shipborne aerial mast anywhere in the world in 1987, plus shortwave test transmissions in 89 and the raid in that year on the Ross Revenge. All this is just a tiny fraction of what you'll hear on The Legend Lives On, a new 44-track CD available at £9.99 inclusive, only from these sources. SMC, P.O. Box 53121 at 1007 RC Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and from Chris Edwards, P.O. Box 1514 London W72LL in England. Radio Caroline, the legend lives on.
Hello to Bill Dunn, who writes in from County Limerick in Southern Ireland. The presenter spoke of a problem with a long wire antenna being overloaded, so a sheet of tinfoil placed somewhere will give the desired effect. I have a Sony ICF 7600, 150 kHz to 30 MHz continuous. My long wire is not doing the job for me. It sounds overloaded. Could you send me details of the tinfoil trick? I enjoy facts very much. Well, what you do is you stand your portable radio on something large and metal. You can either cut yourself a bit of tin foil about 3 foot by 3 foot square, or use a convenient sink radiator or old water tank or sort of thing you have lying around your home. That will increase the ground mat for the radio, capacitively coupling to it, and will increase the signal without detuning or overloading, because it gives you a better ground without detuning the front end of your radio, as often happens if you stick a massive wire on the front. Thanks to Bill Dunn for writing in. And if you've got a portable radio and the signal's a bit weak, give that a try with a bit of tinfoil, etc. This week on Sparks, Century FM, Ireland's first legal countrywide commercial service, closes after barely 2 years on air. Swords to Plowshares, how imaging technology used in the Gulf War could prevent future riverboat tragedies like the Marchioness disaster. We explain the new Philips digital compact cassette, the technical cock-ups behind the launch delays at BSB, the latest developments in national commercial radio in Britain. Let's hope it's more successful than Century, and what prospects are there for the electric car?
New National Radio for the United Kingdom by Tim Smith in International Broadcast Engineer. The BBC until 1990 operated four national radio networks, each carried on both VHF and medium wave, radios 1, 2 and 3, or long wave, radio 4. The launch of BBC Radio 5 in August 1990, using the former Radio 2 medium wave network, was the first step in a plan to develop eight national radio services. These will be carried on either VHF or medium wave, radio 4 retaining VHF and long wave, including three independent national radio channels licensed by the Radio Authority. Three groups submitted valid applications for the first national franchise, INR1, under the terms of the Broadcasting Act 1990, Classic FM, First National Radio, and UK FM. The licence being awarded to the group submitting the highest cash bid, to be adjusted annually for inflation during the 8-year licence period, collected by the Radio Authority and passed on to the Treasury. It was announced on July the 4th that FNR had submitted the highest bid at £1.75 million per annum and would be awarded the licence if the necessary finance for the station, some £20 million, were unconditionally secured within 6 weeks. FNR was unable to confirm the full amount in time. It blamed the difficulty on contacting investors who were away on holiday and asked for an extra month. The Radio Authority met with FNR and decided not to grant an extension. Thus, it was announced on August the 19th that Classic FM, which had made the second highest bid at £670,000 per annum, would be awarded the licence, again subject to the proviso that all funding be secured within 6 weeks, which has of course happened. Classic FM is planning a service of easy access listening to popular masterworks of the great composers, from records and from concerts staged under sponsorship agreements. The group is chaired by David Astor and was initially backed by Carlton Communications, but this backing was withdrawn in April. Investors now include Time Warner, Brian Brolly's Rosk Holdings and GWR, which operates a string of radio stations in the west and south of England. Chief executive of Classic FM is David Maker, Golden Rose Broadcasting, who is also chief executive of Buzz FM, a local radio station in Birmingham. There is considerable incentive to get started, since the licence holder must pay a monthly fee to the radio authority from the date when the licence is granted, which includes several months before broadcasting brings in revenue. The station aims to be on the air by the summer of 1992, with the first part of its VHF transmitter network in place. Getting planning permission for new transmitter masts with frequency approval from national and international authorities could take months or even years. However, the current Geneva International Frequency Agreement already provides for the use of particular INR1 frequencies at 32 existing VHF radio transmitter sites. The radio authority offered this pre-approved plan to applicants, and it has been adopted by Classic FM. The IBA was responsible for the installation and operation of transmitters for ITV, Channel 4 and independent local radio stations until the end of 1990. IBA's licensing and regulatory functions were taken over by the Independent Television Commission and the Radio Authority from the 1st of January 1991, following the Broadcasting Act. Operation of the existing radio and television transmitters passed to National Transcommunications Limited, a commercial company based on the former IBA Engineering Division. New stations are free to make their own arrangements for distribution and transmission, subject to detailed engineering codes established by the regulatory authority. Operation and maintenance will probably be subcontracted to a licensed transmission provider, such as NTL. The BBC is not permitted to tender for this service, but most of the sites in the frequency plan are BBC sites, and others are NTL sites with BBC radio transmitters. So the BBC is required to provide access for the INR1 licensee. Similar arrangements already exist at the UHF television transmitter sites, which are all owned either by the BBC or NTL, and shared by both. The site landlord owns the land, the mast, generally the antenna system, feeder cables, and the main combining equipment. The tenant has a separate transmitter hall with its own power supply, and feeds signals into the main combining equipment. The landlord charges rental for the land and use of the shared facilities. As the BBC effectively has a monopoly of national radio transmitter sites, its charges for providing access will be regulated by Oftel. The Radio Authority allows several stages of development for the INR1 VHF network. For the start of the service, 7 transmitter sites must be operational. These are, in order of approximate population coverage, Rootham, Holm Moss, Sutton Coalfield, Black Hill, Wenvo, Pontoc Pike, and Divis in Northern Ireland. At full power, typically 250 kilowatts ERP, these sites cover some 72% of the UK's population. Initial installations must provide at least 10% of maximum permitted ERP, and every site must deliver at least 50% of its maximum ERP within 1 year of going into service. Coverage is expected to reach at least 85% within 2 years. The authority names a further 15 mandatory sites, using mainly lower-powered transmitters, which will bring coverage up to almost 89%. In order of population coverage, they are Roeridge, Oxford, Tackleston, Peterborough, North Hessery Tor, Belmont, Sheffield, Sandale, Swingate, Kilvey Hill, Darvel, Forfar, Meldrum, Clandonnor and Londonderry. The law of diminishing returns applies with a vengeance, and a further 10 optional sites, making a total of 32, would only bring coverage to just over 90%. These are Brighton, Redruth, Churchdown Hill, Limavady, Haverford West, Perth and Rumpster Forest. If these sites are not used for INR1, their related frequencies will be reallocated by the Radio Authority for other stations to conserve the VHF spectrum. The BBC national VHF networks have been developing for over 35 years and will probably never reach 100% coverage of the UK's population. Radio 2 will have over 160 transmitters in service by the end of 1991, providing nearly 98% coverage. Radio 1 by then will have 65 transmitters, giving more than 95% coverage. Within the next couple of years, INR1 will be joined by two more INR services operating on medium wave. The Radio Authority this autumn is advertising the licence for INR2, which will take over medium wave frequencies currently occupied by BBC Radio 3, probably around mid-1992. INR3 is expected to be advertised during 1992 and to take over medium wave frequencies currently occupied by Radio 1 around mid-1993. The BBC is permitted to offer its existing medium wave transmitter networks for use by the INR licensees. Most of the sites also carry BBC Radio 4 or Radio 5 AM services, so the BBC can continue to operate and maintain all the transmitters, acting as a transmission provider for INR 2 and INR 3. Programme may be fed out from London on the BBC network distribution, or the new stations may choose alternative means. Ofcel will regulate the fees charged by the BBC for these transmission services, as at present it holds a monopoly. By Tim Smith, from International Broadcast Engineer, and of course you notice the BBC are giving up first the rotten frequency of 1215, which carries Radio 3.
Talking, but they just don't know what's in my heart and why I love you so. I love you, baby, like a mine of love gold. Come on, sugar, let the good time roll. Hey. People live and make believe. They keep a lot of dirt up their sleeve. But my love, baby, isn't the kind that fools. Come on, baby, let the good times roll. Hey. Thank you. nice if it's understood. It's even nicer when you're feeling good. You got me flipping like a flag on a pole. Come on, sugar, let the good time roll. Hey!
You're listening to Sparks, every Monday and Tuesday, the weekly programme of scientific, technical and media news on Radiofax 6205 and 12255. And now for the winter in the UK on 3910. Give that a listen if you find 6205 rather full of interference at times. And Sparks this week is presented by Andy Burnham, Trevor Brook and Dave Johns. In audio media, Tim Frost looks forward to next year's planned release of the digital compact cassette from Philips and explains the technology behind it. Philips have so far avoided climbing on the RDAT bandwagon, even though they contributed to its development. They have been saving themselves for the launch of their own digital compact cassette DCC system in April next year. Whilst RDAT is perfect for the musician and studio user, anyone generating their own material, it has not so far resolved the problem of mass duplication of pre-recorded software, which is the key to the domestic market. Philips research shows that there are around 500 million cassette decks in the world, of which 75% are playback-only models, personals and in-car units being the bulk of these. Of the 2.6 billion cassettes purchased each year, 40% are pre-recorded, so any tape format that is not supported by the mass availability of pre-recorded software is unlikely to get beyond the professional and occasional hi-fi enthusiast user. Philips, who it must be said also have an interest in trying to keep their cassette format alive as long as possible, feel that the ideal solution is to fit some sort of digital encoding onto tape housed in a standard compact cassette shell. That way there is some level of continuity between the universal analog cassette and a new digital format. However, since it is not possible to make tape any thinner, the cassette shell restricts the total length of tape available to the 150 metres or so in a C90. So, whatever digital system they were going to use, to obtain a usable playing time, it would have to work with tape speeds similar to that of the standard cassette, 4.76 centimetres a second. The maximum recordable bitrate using a stationary head comes out at just over 0.95 of a megabit per second. To put a standard PCM converted signal onto this format would then require some form of process that will compress the data by at least a factor of 3. Philips have been working with several European developments, one of which is for direct digital radio, DAB, which also needs substantial reduction of the data stream if it is going to work, which it does. Several similar systems have come out of that research, namely Musicam, ASPEC, and the Philips variant Precision Adaptive Subband Coding, or PASC. The system works by taking advantage of the ear and brain's somewhat selective behaviour in focusing in on only some aspects of the received sound waves to identify exactly what is going on. We have a threshold of hearing which varies with frequency, and it is very difficult to perceive sound pressures below those levels. Also, a sound at a given frequency will locally alter the threshold. Another sound, close in frequency but lower in level, may well now fall below the new threshold. In other words, a loud signal will mask a quiet one nearby in frequency. Another useful point is that only in white noise does sound occur in equally high levels at all frequencies. With music, at any one time there are frequency areas where there is little or no sound activity at all. It could thus be considered extravagant to reserve a 96 dB wide sample slot 100% of the time for an area where there is little or no information to be encoded. PASC uses these three principles to throw away the imperceivable chunks of the program material before going to the next encoding stage, redistributing the available bits to the areas where there is signal present. In a DCC deck, the analog input goes through a standard A to D converter, which can operate with any of the common sample rates, and passes the signal on to the PASC processor. This splits the signal into 32 frequency-dependent sub-bands, using digital filtering. The data value of each of the bands is compared with the dynamic threshold of hearing that applies at that moment, taking into account what is happening in nearby frequency bands. Only sub-bands with content above the threshold are given data values. Consequently, many bands will have data levels which have been reduced to a low or zero value. Instead of assigning to each subband 1/32 of the total bits available, the PASC processor allocates bits only when they are needed. So out of the total bit bank available, some bands will be allocated 0 bits, leaving more for the other bands, and giving a substantial saving in the total number of bits needed to describe a musical signal. PASC can allocate up to the equivalent of 18 bits to an individual subband sample, which gives the format a theoretical 12 dB dynamic advantage over CD. After PASC encoding, the digital stream is passed through an error correction encoder and multiplexed into 8 channels of audio data, with a 9th control data track for recording onto tape. A few years ago, creating a cassette head with 9 channels, each only 185 microns wide, the equivalent of 40 tracks on quarter-inch tape, would have been a serious problem. However, several companies now have substantial experience in building thin film heads for digital audio and computer use, and there is seen to be no problems in producing these in mass production quantities. The head will in fact be a combi head, which will rotate through 180 degrees. The top half will record the 9 digital data tracks, and the bottom half will be used to read existing stereo analog tapes. So the new DCC machines can be used both with DCC tapes and the user's back catalogue of analog cassettes. There may be those who are wondering what all this processing is going to do to the overall sound quality. Here, Philips are somewhat reticent, going no further than saying that DCC sound is comparable to that of compact disc, as opposed to identical. There are, however, independent results available from control listening tests on the other similar systems, which showed that this type of processing produces a detectable degradation compared to the original signal, so it is probable that DCC will not quite reach CD and RDAT sound in overall quality terms. The PASC processing will be handled by dedicated DSP chips, which are being developed by both Philips and Matsushita. In addition to the 8 tracks of interleaved audio data, the 9th channel is set aside for control data and text storage. The machines will be able to automatically find any marked point on the tape, much in the same way that RDAT operates. The text storage facility will be able to transfer up to 400 characters per second, making it useful for additional program information, which can relate directly to the track being played at the time. DCC will also be fitted with SCMS, Serial Copy Management System. Hardly surprising, as it is the only way that software houses will allow a new format onto the market nowadays. The tapes will be similar but not quite identical to existing cassettes. All DCC machines will be auto-reverse, and the DCC tapes will have drive spindle holes only on one side. The other, completely flat side, will have a transparent window to be used for our album artwork. The tapes will not need a separate outer case, as they will incorporate a sliding metal cover over the tape surface, similar to the cover on 3.5-inch floppy disks. This is all part of the Philips new high-tech design that they feel cassette needs to bring it into the 90s and beyond. There is a lot of backing for DCC, but the same could be said for RDAT. It is not backwards compatible. You won't be able to play a DCC tape on your old cassette deck, and to begin with anyway, it will probably not quite attain CD quality. But it will still look like a cassette, and have the undisputed pulling power of that magical word, digital. From Audio Media, Tim Frost describing the digital compact cassette, due from Philips next year.
Way the wind blows.